Why do African babies start sitting earlier? The first researchers who started looking at this were so struck, being quite aware at how much earlier it was from the so-called developmental norms, that they called these babies precocious. That term, I think, itself is racist because it assumes a norm from which African babies are diverging. Why shouldn't African babies be the norm? Or why should there be any norm?
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily, and this is the Untaming podcast. And here we are at the full long night's moon in the Southern Hemisphere. We went on a midwinter camping adventure last week to a lovely little beach we'd never been to before. We set up our tents right on the rocks on the beach. We were there two nights and had it all to ourselves. And with the last episode with Casper van der Meulen on cold exposure still fresh in my mind, I didn't need too much encouragement to get in the water, albeit briefly. Our two-year-old had been begging to go in since we'd arrived, so she was ecstatic when she finally had the opportunity to go in and try surfing with her papa. Once our five-year-old saw how much fun she was having, he begged to try surfing too. But ultimately, he slipped headfirst off the board on his first wave and came back out immediately. Then he sat there for the next 20 minutes, wrapped up in a towel, staring out at the water, murmuring how it felt like he was floating and he could taste the salt, and how he has been so scared of putting his head under the water, but now he's realized it isn't actually scary. I even overheard him describing it to his little sister the next day. Do you remember what it was like when you were in Mama's belly? It's just like that, like you're floating. Needless to say, he's eager to try it again. The next episode, which will be airing on the 10th of July to coincide with the new ice moon, will be with Andy Mant on the effects and implications of natural and artificial light exposure. I hope you enjoyed the last 10 questions in 10 minutes episode with my very own mother. The next of those will be coming out on the 2nd of July, the last quarter of the long night's moon. Today's episode is one that our guest host Mary Francelle did with Alma Gottlieb, and I will stop rattling on now so you can hear them.
Welcome to the Untaming podcast. I'm your occasional guest host, Mary Francelle, IBCLC. I have a private practice in Bellingham, Washington, and I also blog at www.whatdobabiesneed.com. I'd like to welcome my guest, Dr. Alma Gottlieb. Dr. Gottlieb holds a PhD in anthropology from the University of Virginia. She is the co-author or co-editor of 9 books. She began her publishing career with Blood Magic, The Anthropology of Menstruation, an award-winning collection that helped inaugurate a modern feminist approach to menstruation cross-culturally. It's the recipient of the first award for the most enduring collection offered by the Council of Anthropology of Reproduction, part of the Society of Medical Anthropology of the American Anthropological Association. Dr. Gottlieb has held fellowships and grants from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Social Science Research Council, and has held teaching or research appointments at Princeton University, École des Hautes Études in Paris, Catholic University of Louvain, and elsewhere. A professor emerita at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Dr. Gottlieb is currently a visiting scholar in anthropology at Brown University and a visiting professor at Minzu University in Beijing. She blogs at www.almagottlieb.com, and she has written a book that I'm particularly interested in relation to our podcast called A World of Babies, Imagined Childcare Guides for 7 Societies. She co-edited this volume with Judy Deloche, and it's a collection of imagined parenting manuals based on well-documented ethnography. She's currently researching Cape Verdeans who have Jewish heritage and is at work on a book tentatively titled Africa Across the Seder Table, Jewish Identity in the Cape Verdean Diaspora. Last night, she had 7 hours of sleep. And for lunch today, she had homemade bread toasted with cheese, some raw carrots, and a leftover grains dish that her husband made a few nights ago. Welcome, Dr. Gottlieb. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you.
So I'd like to get started by talking a little bit about what drew you to anthropology way back when, and in particular, what has made you interested in parenting practices in different cultures?
Sure. They're seemingly different questions, but perhaps in my case related. In both cases, I was drawn to the world. I was intrigued by reading about the variety of ways that humans live their lives around the globe. That appealed to my adolescent imagination. I first learned about the existence of anthropology in a high school health education class, of all things. I was in high school in the late 60s when culture was in a very particularly turbulent period, and it happened that my high school health education teacher was one of these progressive guys who decided to use health as education as a way for teaching mental health and introduced us to yoga and meditation, all sorts of alternative practices that were still considered alternative in the US in the late 60s. And included in that list of, from his perspective, exotica, was practices of the Hopi people of the Southwest, whom he introduced as the world's only full-time pacifists. And that really caught my imagination. I spent my adolescence protesting the Vietnam War, as well as marching for civil rights and women's rights. I was already very politically active. I was born into a politically active family. And learning that there was a society that, according to my health teacher, turns out he wasn't quite accurate, but according to my health teacher, was the most peaceful society on the world at a time when our society was bombing innocent villagers halfway around the world, really sparked my imagination and got me thinking and reading. I spent my senior year in high school doing an independent study on the Hopi Indians, and decided to study anthropology at some point in college, remembering my Hopi study. The second part of your question also relates to a similar quest, not quite so idealistic, because of course I did come to learn that there are no utopian societies on the world, in the world, even the Hopi have sources of violence. But there certainly is a great diversity of ways of living our lives, and some societies do tend to put more of a premium on specific kinds of social justice than others. Parenting became a near and dear topic of interest to me through a very personal route, and that was becoming a mother. And having a child in particular, our first child, who happened to cry a lot his first 3 months for no reasons that anybody could understand, except some vague claim of something called colic, which turned out to mean nothing except that your child cries a lot for no reasons that we can explain, led me scratching my head. And none of the advice given to me by fellow mothers or fathers or doctors or nurses or anybody else worked for longer than a minute. This kid just seemed to be crying. Until I started thinking back to the villages where I had lived for lengthy periods of time in the rainforest in West Africa, in Côte d'Ivoire or Ivory Coast. And I kept thinking back to my memories of what Bang mothers would do when their babies cried. And I had very few memories. I couldn't even recall or recreate in my mind's ear the sound of a crying baby crying for very long. And so that really caught my attention. And the more I thought about what did I know about babies' lives in these villages, the more I had two very powerful memories. One, that they were spending a lot of time at abreast. nursing. And the other was that when they weren't breastfeeding, they were spending a lot of time being carried on somebody's back. And I remembered that it seemed to be not always mothers' backs. But when I had been living in these villages, I hadn't been a mother. I hadn't really been paying that much attention to children in general, let alone babies. So I had this vague sense that maybe a lot of breastfeeding and a lot of back carrying had something to do with these babies not crying so much. But I started thinking about how little I had actually observed about babies and mothers' lives and how much there must be to observe. And for an anthropologist to recognize that you were blind to reality is a provocation. We like to think that we're trained to observe everything, and it turns out we're not. We observe what interests us and what appeals to us.
That's wonderful. I can imagine that it was fascinating for you once you became a mother to kind of think back to all of these things that you observed and, oh, yes, that makes sense. So as an anthropologist, can you explain for us what the acronym WEIRD, W-E-I-R-D, stands for among anthropologists and other scientists?
I love that acronym. It was actually a psychologist who came up with it about 10 years ago. It's an ironic acronym. It stands for kind of the same and kind of the opposite of what you'd think. So Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic. In other words, quote unquote, us, that is educated Western or Westernized, Western educated elites. And it's ironic because it's exactly those people, people like me and you, whose children have been the focus of 95% of the studies of children done by developmental psychologists, on the basis of which they have crafted theories that purportedly have universal relevance. In other words, they study middle-class and upper-middle-class white American children, and on the basis of those studies in laboratories, not even in their homes ethnographically, make pronouncements about human nature and the nature of human babies, supposedly with biological foundations. But 95% of those studies are done with a population that is anything other than representative. It only represents 5% of the world and the world's children. And so psychologists, having recently discovered the world of anthropology, thank goodness, have been going through a really interesting phase of autocritique of the sort that we've been doing in anthropology for a very long time, and have begun questioning to some extent their methods, but even more the scope of their claims. Mm-hmm. And in recognizing that studying only 5% of the world's population doesn't really give you a basis for making universalizing theories about human nature or children's nature or children's development, they came up with this fantastic acronym to represent us as weird, to turn the exoticizing gaze on its head and remind us in a brutal way that, in fact, the developmental so-called norms that you read about in every developmental psychology textbook, every medical textbook, every pediatric textbook, the basis of which forms every pediatrician's milestones for every Western child's well baby visits into the second year, all of those need to be revisited because they're based on a statistical outlier, 5% of the world's population. And in fact, statistically, we, quote unquote, are the weird ones. So that's why I love this acronym.
I love it too. I think that's absolutely fabulous. And I really, it's so interesting to hear you say all of that because there's so many so-called weird parents today who worry so much that they're harming their children if somehow they don't parent, quote unquote, correctly. Now, your book, A World of Babies, outlines child-rearing practices in about 8 different cultures, showing a wide variety of how parents raise children all around the world. So could you give some examples of perhaps the different environments in which children sleep or how they are fed or different disciplinary practices to kind of shed light on the wide variety we find around the world?
Absolutely. Since we're talking about weird and typically there are motor and other neurological developments involved in a lot of these claims, assuming that human nature has to have some strong biological foundation that's going to govern all human development. So if you look at the textbooks for motor development, typically, again, based on white middle-class American children observed in laboratories, the timeline is 6 months to sit up, 9 months, give or take a month, to start crawling, maybe 10 months, somewhere between a year and a year and a half to start walking. Well, it turns out that those norms look very different. For example, in the kinds of villages in the West African rainforest where I've done my research. And in typically, and this is across much of Africa, not even just West Africa, across much of sub-Saharan Africa, including in places studied in East Africa, Kenya and elsewhere, babies typically start sitting at a much earlier age than 6 months. Another wonderful way to challenge these stereotypes, because the assumption based on pure racism is that white babies' norms are accelerated. And if any place they're going to differ, it will be lower because somehow we have the best child rearing methods, right? So across Africa, children start sitting on their own around 3 months often. And often are fully able to sit up by at least 5 months and often by 4 months. And to an adult of an age that you and I are, a month may not sound like very much, but that's about a third of a lifetime for an infant. And as any new parent knows, an incredible amount happens in a month in a new baby's life. So to think about the difference of being able to sit at 4 months or 5 months as opposed to 6 months is pretty huge for that time period. Why do African babies start sitting earlier? The first researchers who started looking at this were so struck, being quite aware at how much earlier it was from the so-called developmental norms, that they called these babies precocious. That term, I think, itself is racist because it assumes a norm from which African babies are diverging. Why shouldn't African babies be the norm? Or why should there be any norm? Maybe we just don't have a single basic norm, right? The next question is, why are these babies sitting at a much younger age than white middle-class American babies? And that's pretty clear. It's because of the back carrying that I just mentioned. So much of their days, they're strapped to somebody's back. And in that position, they're in a quasi-seated position. Their backs are vertical. Their legs are wrapped around horizontally the torso of whoever is carrying them. And if it's a child, which it often is in these villages, their legs are wrapped around pretty completely because it's a small torso. So they're really in a quasi-sitting position. And because their spines are upright, they wind up developing neck control at a much earlier age than typical middle-class white American babies because they're motivated and they're upright. And so by 4 months, typically many, many of these babies can sit by themselves. By 5 months, probably most. And by 6 months, already parents are starting to get a little nervous if they're not, that something may be wrong. So that's just one classic example of how development in even the seemingly rigid biological timetable that our textbooks tell us should be observed globally, it doesn't really work. Sleeping is related to that. We have a sense in the middle class in the US that sleeping is best accommodated in one position, that is horizontally. From decade to decade, the advice changes about whether it should be on the stomach, the back, or the side. I've lived long enough to see all three of those change from decade to decade. But what doesn't change is the horizontal nature. And also what doesn't change is typically the advice to put the baby in a separate space, close the door, turn off the lights, turn off music, put quiet baby sleeping signs around, and basically keep a very closed, tight environment. That's the opposite of how babies all around Africa and much of the global south beyond Africa, including much of Asia as well, sleep. So in the villages where I've worked, babies during the day spend most of their nap time vertical and moving, rather than horizontal and stationary. They spend most of their nap time on somebody's back who's walking. So they develop, I would say, a certain flexibility in being able to fall asleep. I didn't study this, but my impression is that fewer adults have sleep issues than adults in America. I am guessing, it's just a hypothesis. I'm putting it out there for some biological anthropologists maybe to investigate. But I'm guessing that it has to do with the ability to fall asleep very easily in any circumstance from the earliest days. And the other phenomenon that really struck me, and this I did start studying quantitatively, was how long babies would spend sleeping on the back of one person as opposed to another person. And it turns out that they are not picky about whose back they'll sleep on. They are quite willing to be passed from back to back. And that concern that so many North American mothers have of not waking a sleeping baby because it'll take them forever to go back to sleep just doesn't exist. There's a sense that if the baby needs to sleep, it will find its way to sleep. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't need to sleep. There's no sense of a strict schedule. When I asked about what kind of schedule mothers might put their babies on, it was really hard to figure out how to ask that question, because no matter how I asked it, they didn't understand it. It was an alien concept. As far as they know, babies sleep when they need to sleep.
Absolutely. We've got so much now, even more since my kids have grown, it seems that there's all this in Western society, this information about wake windows and how long a baby needs to be awake before they go to sleep and how you need to set the environment. And I try to tell people in my sleep group, just, you know, try not to worry about that. Every baby is an individual. And if you just want them to have any flexibility in where they sleep, you need to just like let them sleep wherever, whatever sounds, whatever. It's, you know, and yet we have so much concern and so much tension around this issue. And I love that you were talking about that, because I think it's really, really true. And we also often hear people saying, oh, they'll only sleep on my chest. They will only sleep on my chest. And, you know, they're so worried about the whole back to sleep issue. And I try to emphasize, it's completely natural for a baby want to sleep on a chest. That's how they've been doing it for thousands of years, or on a back. You know, and if they're on a person, it's a very different experience than lying flat prone, you know, in a separate room. So I love that you're mentioning that, because that's so important for people to be aware of. So,
but at the same time, I would like to add that I'm not advocating that American parents carry their babies all day long the way people do. I'm not just going to say mothers, because, and I'm here, I'm speaking from very personal experience. If you don't have a large group of people to move this baby back and forth among, you're going to wind up with back trouble. I personally had back surgery from a herniated disc from doing too much of this. So there is a cultural context, a social context, in which it makes sense to carry babies. And the prime requirement is you need a lot of backs, because one back isn't going to hold out.
Absolutely. I really feel it's so important that parents develop their own village whenever possible, you know, so that you have some relief. If you can you know, live close to your family or enlist a group of friends to, you know, help with each other's children, it makes a huge difference. But you're right, you're not going to be able to specifically recreate that whole environment unless you really work hard at it. So
another issue we have in the U.S., and this is something that's, I think, very much on the eyes of the current new administration, is parental leave, maternity and paternity leave. You certainly can't imagine for most working parents carrying a baby for any stretch of the day if you're working, unless you're working from home. And even so, it becomes a little bit problematic. So if we look at, for example, the Scandinavian countries that have anywhere from 6 months to a full year of paid parental leave, that starts becoming a condition that can make possible more baby carrying. But again, I'm not going to advocate that somebody spend a year carrying their baby because they may wind up in the hospital as I did.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. There's other ways that hopefully you can find to mix in some carrying with, you know, other ways of, you know, getting other people involved in your baby care as well. Absolutely.
You know, I remember when my first child was born and I came back from the hospital. I was healthy. He was healthy. And I just somehow intuitively sensed that I needed help. I wasn't yet a specialist in the anthropology of childcare, but I just sensed that I needed help. And I started calling all my friends. I didn't have any family living nearby. And they were very reluctant to come over. They said, well, don't you need bonding time?
Right.
And are you sure I won't be getting in the way? And what if I might have germs? They were very nervous. And once I started studying birthing rituals in these villages in Ivory Coast, I was so struck by how they had the exact opposite impulse from the traditional middle class American impulse. The minute a baby emerges from a womb, as long as the mother has survived and the baby has survived and there doesn't seem to be anything medically wrong urgently, a child is dispatched from the household within about a minute of the baby emerging, right? Yeah, right after the umbilical cord is cut. A child is dispatched, an older child, somewhere between maybe 7 and 15 or so. And they're basically like a runner to announce the birth. And they are required to go to every household and announce to every household, this baby has just been born. And then within maybe 15 minutes, there's a line of one representative from every household. So in a large village, there might be 200 or 300 people, a line standing outside her door, and one by one, they go in. And she's lying there. She's just recovering from childhood birth, maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes ago. And one by one, they ask her, what have you given me? And those are the pronouns they use. What have you given me? And she responds with the gender. I have given you either a boy or a girl. And then they say, thank you. And if they have a little extra coin, they toss a coin to her for a little gift. So right there, the mother is being given maximum community support. She's being told that this child is not only her child, the child belongs to the village. The village is going to look after this child. This is a child of the community. And she doesn't have to fear being abandoned, being alone, being confused. As she's starting to position her baby to breastfeed, quite a few of the women who are in the line may be starting to investigate how's the latching going on. First time breastfeeding, especially for a first time mother, can be problematic. Maybe the baby doesn't have a strong sucking mechanism. Maybe her colostrum hasn't come in. So she'll be getting a lot of unasked for advice. She might ask for some, but usually she doesn't even have to ask for any. So this is a very different perspective from when an American woman goes home from the hospital and she's all by herself. And as I did, gets a breast infection within the first week because I was so stressed out with nobody to help.
Absolutely. And I love some other cultures as well that basically give the mother a month of care, at least a month. And primarily it tends to be family, but also community. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think sometimes the whole idea of, oh, I have to get up and do things, and then, oh, I have to put the baby on my back because I have to, you know, carry them around and everything, where I love this. We have a new phenomenon that seems people are calling it contact napping, which is where you just let the baby sleep on your chest. And I think that is so wonderful because, yes, you don't have to just carry the baby around. Sometimes you can just hold the baby while they sleep and you can get your rest too. And I know that they do this in a lot of cultures, particularly in the first month for the mothers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. In China, that practice is translated into English as sitting the month. Mm-hmm. And there's a version of that in all East Asian societies. There's a young anthropologist named Yunjun Kang who has just finished a dissertation about that practice in Korea. Where it is becoming so modernized and she would say commodified, that there are now postpartum clinics that have opened up all around Seoul and other cities. And middle class and wealthy women can book a month ahead of time while they're still pregnant in one of these postpartum clinics where they will be pampered. All of their physical and emotional needs will be taken care of, as will the babies, as she just rests. And depending on her class position, it may be a little bit luxurious or, you know, really like a five-star spa. So that's a modern urbanized version of a long-standing tradition that has probably existed in China for maybe a couple thousand years. And it's very common in many societies around the world to have some version of that. When I ask Bang women, when would they normally go back to farming? They are full-time farmers. They told me minimum 4 weeks, but really anybody who goes back to farming after 4 weeks is going to have a lot of health problems and may not be able to successfully carry another baby. They said 6 weeks is really the rock bottom minimum, but they'd like to go 3 months if they can. And so during those 3 months, they're getting a lot of help. If their mother is around, their mother's helping a lot. If their mother-in-law is around, they're getting two grandmothers and any older sisters, as well as cousins, older children, and anybody else. In West African villages, and this is across the global south, and here it's really a function of weather and climate, a lot of life is lived outdoors. And so if you're outdoors with a baby, babies attract adults and they attract older children. And in fact, Bang mothers decorate their babies' bodies in such a way as to attract more admirers, specifically to attract more babysitters. So every morning, a mother bathes her baby and then applies face paints to the face and also to parts of the body. And some of these are considered medicinal via a form of magic, but some of them are just considered purely cosmetic. And even the ones that are considered medicinal are applied in an aesthetic way so as to attract people. They're also laid in with jewelry. Again, some of these items are considered to have magical efficacy for specific diseases, different beads guard against particular sicknesses, but they're also considered beautiful. And the more jewelry a baby wears, it said, the more people are going to be so taken by this baby's beauty that they're going to want to carry this baby. And this is male or female. This is not gendered at all.
I love that. That was one thing I just loved reading about in your book. And I know that it also, the jewelry sometimes connects with the Bang belief in that babies come from the afterlife and they miss things in the afterlife. And can you talk a little bit about the relationship of babies and the afterlife in that culture? It's so interesting.
Yeah. You know, when I went back to study Bang child rearing, I had already spent quite some time in these villages. I'd written quite a lot about their indigenous religion. And I figured in returning to the communities, I was done with religion. I was taking on a whole new topic of children and child rearing. And I was a little surprised to discover that I was back in the land of religion. Because the more I asked about the why questions, why do you do this? Not just how, but why, the more the answers were taking me towards religious answers. And I discovered that there's a whole idea of the afterlife that nobody had ever even talked that much about with me. Even though I'd asked about religion, they told me about a lot of other features of religion, but nobody had really thought to talk much about the afterlife. I think because I was asking the wrong questions, or at least omitting the questions that would have led me to the afterlife, because those questions were all around infancy and I wasn't asking about infancy. So it turns out the Beng have this idea that anybody who knows anything about, for example, Hinduism would find somewhat familiar. There are differences, but the basic idea is that life keeps coming around and around. It's not, there's no end point. The afterlife leads back to this life. And every child is a reincarnation of somebody else. In some cases, you may know who is the ancestor who's become reincarnated in the child. In many cases, you may not. But everybody has this other experience. And when an infant emerges from the womb, the idea is that they're not just coming from a physical space inside a woman's body, they're actually coming from a spiritual space in this other afterlife. And they still have memories from that afterlife. So a lot of Beng child-rearing practices are oriented around a desire to lure the child from that afterlife into this life so that they're not tempted to return. The idea is that the afterlife is an idyllic place, and everybody who lives there has all of their needs fulfilled. There's no hunger, there's no poverty. It's conceived of, this is I found particularly intriguing, as multilingual. So there are no communication gaps. Everybody understands everybody's language. And of course, we know that many of the world's troubles, both interpersonally and politically, come from miscommunication. So the Beng have solved that problem in the afterlife. And of course, this life isn't idyllic like that. People have fights. There is poverty. There's want. There's suffering. Babies are said to observe these lacks and are said to be nostalgic for the easier life that they left behind. There is a high infant mortality in these areas of West Africa, a lot of pathogens. And the younger the child, biologically, the more vulnerable they are to these pathogens. And the Beng explanation for much of the infant deaths that afflict their communities is that the child was missing too much of that afterlife. And so a lot of child-rearing practices are all about being as loving and welcome as possible to these children. So these children are really loved. And the idea of passing them around is partly to help the woman recover from childbirth, partly to give her rest and recuperation and allow her to get back on her feet and not wind up with a herniated disc as I did, but also partly to make the baby happy, to just surround the baby with love from as many people as possible so that they feel welcome in this community and not tempted to return.
And am I remembering correctly that the reason they don't want the children to walk before a year has something to do with this as well?
It does. It does. So this is something that really shocked me, because those developmental norms about walking, again, are typically seen as so biologically inevitable. The Beng say that a certain baby may want to walk early, but they will not allow any baby to walk early. Before 1 year, they will not allow a child to walk. After 1 year, they're fine. But for the first year, they say, because of this reincarnation cycle, that if a baby walks before a year, they are, and here I'm translating into English a direct phrase from the Beng language, they're walking on the spirit of one of their ancestors, or I'm sorry, one of their relatives, living relatives, usually a grandparent, but it might be somebody else. And if that happens, that person will die soon. So the two of them can't be in this life walking together during the first year.
Wow, that's
and great. So if a child is motorically, we would say, precocious and starting to walk at 9, 10, or even 11 months, they'll just strap that child to somebody's back all day long. They literally will imprison the baby and not allow them to walk.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, one other thing I found so interesting about your research was the idea that it's so important to teach the babies to insult their siblings and their grandparents. And, you know, they just think that's the best thing in the world is to call them these dirty names to, you know, make things fun in the family. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, not siblings, but grandparents. So grandparents and grandchildren as opposite generations have what anthropologists have long called a joking relationship. That's a well-documented thing in anthropological literature. And in many societies around the world, that kind of joking relationship does exist between grandparents and grandchildren. Not always, sometimes there are others, but it is a very formulaic relationship. The idea, sometimes we say this in English, is that opposing generations share an enemy, right? That intervening generation. So parents and or grandparents and grandchildren each understand who the bad guys are. So they have a very particular relationship, and grandparents will teach their very young grandchildren from the age that they're just starting to learn language, how to insult them. And they will use really raunchy language to insult their grandparents, usually their grandparents of the opposite sex. So these are very sexualized terms. Sometimes people will tease young children and say that they're married to their grandparents. There's no actual incest going on, but it's seen as outrageous, right? But grandparents and grandchildren have a very special bond that violates normal taboos. And there is something, I won't say universal, because I'm always reluctant to make those claims since we haven't studied everything about every society, but there's something quite common about that shared relationship in many societies. It doesn't always take this extreme turn.
Right. Wonderful. So, you know, I wanted to turn a little bit to a slightly different subject. And that is that, you know, sometimes I know that parents in Western cultures, sometimes, you know, they say people that might practice, say, attachment parenting or want to go towards more natural parenting practices, sometimes they will romanticize parenting in other countries, you know, thinking, oh, they do everything so naturally, it's so biologically normal, we should do things the way they do it. But there are a number of practices in different communities that, you know, could be seen very negatively by us weird parents, such things like female circumcision, you know, a lot of physical force used in discipline, strict gender roles, things like that. Could you talk a little bit about those kinds of things that we might find in other cultures?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that every society has its ideas about the best and worst ways to raise children. And that is one universal, although the components of what those ideas are vary dramatically. But every group makes judgments about other child-rearing practices. So, for example, when I started asking about sleeping patterns, I was intrigued in the villages I was living in Ivory Coast, to observe nighttime sleeping patterns. I've talked about daytime naps, but at night, babies sleep always with their mothers and often with other older children as well. And so it's kind of a crowded bed. And the idea of putting a baby to sleep by itself, whether in a crib, bassinet, or on the ground, would be inconceivable. And when I started asking questions about this, mothers were curious about why I would be asking questions. And I said, well, back where I come from, babies typically don't sleep with anybody. They sleep in their own beds. And they were horrified. I would have to say, if they had a concept of DCFS, they would probably say, we need to send those parents to DCFS. The children need to be taken away from those parents because they're being abused. Right? So why are they being abused? Because in these communities, the best way to raise a child is as part of a community. And the first place that community starts is in the family, but it expands outwards, as I've mentioned. And isolating a child for a life of independence, which is what we prize so highly in the American middle class, is not a goal. Their goal is interdependence rather than independence. They want to assure children that they are part of a community. So when we look at what practices that we consider abusive, it's important to recognize that the reasons that we consider them abusive may have to do more with ultimately, I won't say arbitrary, but particular values that we prize for historical reasons. Now, when we're talking about bodily modification that involves potential medical catastrophes, that's a different scenario. But when we're talking about practices that don't have any potential deleterious medical effects, but create a different kind of consciousness, then we're really talking about values.
Absolutely. I felt like that was so important to bring up, because we have people that will look down upon, you know, the spanking or whatever that's done in different cultures. And yet they don't realize that those cultures might look at them putting their baby in a crib and just be just as horrified by what they're doing and feel that's abusive. So I think that's a really important point.
And I'm not trying to say that there's no such thing as child abuse. I do want to make that clear. I am absolutely not making that claim. But I am suggesting, before we immediately brand something as abusive, first, let's ask the question, why is it done? What does it mean to people? Do people in the local community consider it abusive? For example, in the villages where I've worked, spanking is done, but there are definite norms about when it's too much. And I was living, the last time I was there, in a compound in which one young mother was spanking her children, two children, a child who was six and another who was nine, quite a lot. And everybody was quite upset about it, including her mother, the children's grandmother. And people started saying to me, but loudly, in a way that she could hear, if she keeps doing that, she's going to have her children taken away from her. And that was not going to be by any government agency. That was going to be by another grandparent, the children's paternal grandparents who lived in another village. And one day, the younger child was a good buddy of my son, who was with us at that point. He was six, and he was really concerned to see his buddy being spanked a lot by his buddy's mom. And one day he went up to her, and my son was a little kid, a little six-year-old. He went up to her and he tapped on her back and he rebuked her really soundly in English. She didn't understand a word of it, but she understood everything, right, without understanding a word. And I was very curious to see what the result of that really interesting intercultural exchange would have been. And I didn't see her spank him again that summer that harshly. But her mother, my friend, did tell me that if it continued much longer, she was going to lose that child.
Absolutely. Peer pressure and community pressure, you know, are for good and bad in various situations. And absolutely, I can mm-hmm. see that for sure. So your book, A World of Babies, outlines some immigrant communities who have, you know, immigrated to other countries and their struggle to maintain their traditional parenting practice while in this other country. Could you talk about a couple of these communities and what they have done to stay connected to their culture while still trying to assimilate into whatever culture they've entered?
Yeah, I think this is a universal challenge for immigrants everywhere. We have several immigrant groups that we profile in the new edition of A World of Babies. Maybe I'll talk about one chapter written by a Somali American about Somali immigrants. And I find this chapter particularly compelling because these immigrants have so many strikes against them. They're Black, they're Muslim, and they come from a country that has been branded a nation of pirates, as if being Black and Muslim weren't enough strikes against them already in a racist, anti-Islamic, Islamophobic society. So they really have a lot of challenges. They traditionally, back home, before their society was riven by civil war for reasons that I won't get into, but ultimately provoked by European colonial forces. Before all that, they lived in communities, something like the communities I've been talking about among the Beng, with differences. They are Muslim, the Beng mostly are not, and they lived closer to cosmopolitan, we might say, urban societies because of geography. But they did live in tight-knit communities, even in cities. And they have a tradition of not speaking to very young children directly. That's just not a thing they do, unlike the Beng, who are constantly speaking to their children to lure them from the afterlife. Somalis don't do that. But when they were living in these communities, young children were hardly bereft of linguistic stimulation because they were hearing all the time in their courtyards, adults and other older children speaking to each other, if not to them. When they moved to the US, and the case study in our book is in Minneapolis, they're moving to high rises. And sometimes there are some other family, Somali families in these high rises, but they might not be on their same floor. They might not be in the same building, or there may not be any, or they may not be friends. They may not know them. They may come from other parts of Somalia and so forth. And the upshot is that many of these families wind up living very isolated lives as nuclear families, similar to how many American white middle-class families would live, but without the social ties. And because of the linguistic difference and the religious difference, they're really isolated far more than even most American nuclear families would be. And because of gender norms, the mothers often don't venture out of their apartments much during the day with their babies, and they're not encouraged traditionally to speak to their babies. So as a result, many of these young Somali children are showing speech delays in ways that they wouldn't have in Somalia. And when they're entering kindergarten, they're testing in ways that the state is taking note of and classifying them as delayed language learners. There's a higher rate of autism among these children that's really concerning. And so these are signs that immigration is not a simple process. It's not a one-size-fits-all process. And parents, especially new parents coming from very different cultural backgrounds, need a lot of guidance for how to adapt in ways that are going to allow their children to thrive in circumstances that are so vastly different from those that they would have been comfortable with back home.
Yeah, I think I remember you talking about they have like women's organizations, Muslim women's organizations that sometimes will help other women connect with each other, other parents, or even, I think maybe even online groups that they, maybe they, is there something, what are some things that they might do to kind of compensate for these issues?
Yes, absolutely. And these days, social media can be such an incredible gift. And especially for somebody who's stuck at home, we've all around the globe learned, you and I are now conversing with this incredible technology. So especially for people who are stuck at home, whether it be because of the pandemic or cultural norms or linguistic challenges or anything else, social media is absolutely an incredible opportunity. There's another interesting case study of a different kind of immigration system that we profile in the book, another chapter about the Faroe Islands, which is a semi-autonomous province of islands off the coast of Denmark. Very different scenario. And here, there are a lot of women who have been brought in to marry men on the islands, because there's a much higher out-migration rate of women than men from these islands to the mainland. A lot of women are finding their ways to Copenhagen, where they are pursuing higher education, universities, for various reasons. Not so many men are doing that. And so there's a demographic gender imbalance. And so men are finding their ways to enticing women from Russia, Thailand, and a few other places.
Philippines,
thank you. You read the chapter carefully. As brides. And so they are trying to raise Danish children as immigrants. So they themselves need help trying to figure out what does it mean to raise a Danish child for my Danish husband in this country that I don't know that much about. One of their biggest sources of help is actually from the government. So this is one of the classic Northern European socialist democratic governments that has tremendous government support for social services. And the way the Danish maternity care works, as soon as a woman is diagnosed as pregnant, she becomes connected with a maternity nurse. The maternity nurse has undergone, I think, something like 3 years of extra training. Mm-hmm. And she's really very, very specialized and has a tremendous knowledge source. And in these isolated islands, there are several on each island, and they are stationed there for several years. They get to know the local population. They circulate from one woman's home to another. They connect them with pregnancy groups. And after childbirth, they stay together. They meet and they form their own support group. But also after pregnancy, the Danish state provides for, now I'm forgetting, but maybe 6 months of paid leave, or it might even be a year. Anyway, a lot more than the US, which is 0 days of paid leave right now. And we have 6 weeks of unpaid leave.
Right, exactly.
And yeah. And so during that period, the maternity nurse comes and visits. The first week she visits, I think maybe 2 or 3 times in the first week. After that, once a week for the first couple months. After that, every month, she's coming and making visits all the time, and then getting together other women in the same community to get to know each other. So she's cobbling together a support group for these immigrant women, as well as local women who haven't emigrated. So there are a lot of different ways to form support groups. They can be virtual, online, they can be governmentally produced, they can be local from friendship networks. There's no one size fits all. But I think one of the takeaways is new mothers need help somehow, whether it be friends, government agents, neighbors, relatives, do-gooders, somebody. They need
absolutely
help.
Absolutely. So, so important. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, it's just not, it's not necessarily going to come to you if you're not in a community already, or you don't have a culture where that's normal for people to come in. You have to go out and try to, you know, meet people, stop people who have strollers in your neighborhood, whatever it is, you've got to put together your community to have that for while you raise your children. So I wanted to do one, I have one last question, and then I'd like to see if you have anything else to add. And that is that we mentioned a little bit about religion with the Bang and with the Somali Muslims. And you know, there obviously there's many, you know, different religions around the world. But how do specifically in some of the situations you've looked at, how do they influence parenting practices in different cultures? That's kind of an important issue that we, you know, just touched on so far.
Absolutely. When we think about religion, we tend to think about adults. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the hidden topics in child development, child psychology, parenting practices, the study of the family, how religion shapes values in such a way that it filters down to the very first moments of life, or even in utero. In the first edition of A World of Babies, which came out some years ago, one of the chapters highlights Balinese child-rearing practices from the Indonesian island of Bali, which was a really interesting historical crossroads that attracted many Indian traders. And so there's a big dose of Hindu influence on that particular island, more than other Indonesian islands. And their traditional Balinese versions of Hinduism shape a great deal of the first year of life in ways that are maybe somewhat parallel to how I've been talking about for the Beng. The Balinese idea is that a new infant is like royalty. They're a kind of a god, and they must be treated as a god. And like all gods, their bodies have to be attended to in certain ways. In traditional Balinese Hindu-influenced religion, the head is the most important part of a god, and it should always be raised. And so for the first year of life, whenever an infant is carried, the head always has to be higher. When the child is breastfeeding, the head always has to be raised. So you can't be keeping a child absolutely prone in a flat position, either carrying or breastfeeding. The feet can't touch the ground. They are elevated like gods. So there are lots of just seemingly trivial practices that are really grounded in very consistent religious ideologies. When the woman is pregnant, she herself is treated as a god. The idea is she has to be approached by everybody in general and by her husband in particular in really careful ways to make sure that she isn't upset. No one, especially her husband, can pick a fight with her. She has to really be coddled emotionally. She should not be surrounded by negative emotions, sadness or anger or annoyance, frustration. Otherwise, it's said it will have an impact on the fetus growing inside her. So there seemed to be a really intimate tie emotionally between a mother and the growing child inside her. The uterus, the umbilical cord, the after effects of childbirth, all those are seen as gods themselves. And after the childbirth, the afterbirth, and the umbilical cord are buried in a ritual that has particular details in the courtyard. And the space where these are buried will always be venerated. The child will always be told where her umbilical cord and afterbirth were buried, and will be taught to venerate it. If there's difficulty during the childbirth, if the mother is having trouble getting this baby out, it's said that the four gods within her are upset, and a Balinese priest will come and start praying to the four gods, which are the umbilical cord, the blood, the uterus, and so forth, in order to placate them. So there are lots and lots of spiritual ideas in specific communities that take different particular contours. But in general, it seems to be quite common that religion shapes not just child rearing, but childbirth and even pregnancy in ways that we perhaps don't always take notice of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember, I think in several cultures that you outlined, or your contributors outlined, the umbilical cord, when it's the dried part of the umbilical cord, is often used as almost an amulet to protect the baby, almost like it's just something from the safety of the womb or the before life or whatever it is. And it really helps protect the baby. So yeah.
Among some Australian Aborigines, the subject of another chapter in the first edition of World of Babies, that's also the case. The idea is wherever a baby's umbilical cord was buried, that is home. No matter where they wander in the world, they'll always need to and want to come home to that spot that has rooted them to that spot.
Wow, that's amazing. So is there anything else that you think we should you know, we should have covered that I didn't have a chance to ask you about in particular? I mean, we've covered a lot of subjects, but I wanted to see if you had anything in particular you wanted to add.
You know, for a Western audience, I would say have fun reading, you know, chapters such as the ones that we've included in this book and elsewhere, learning about other child-rearing practices, if anything appeals to you, if it seems viable and it seems to make sense with your worldview and your values and it's pragmatically feasible, give it a try. But for me, the big lesson that I've learned studying child-rearing practices around the world is that there is no one right way to raise children, even in a particular society, and especially in a diverse, complicated, multicultural society like the U.S. But there are always going to be variations at the individual level, even in small, seemingly homogeneous, tight-knit communities, and certainly in complicated ones like ours. So, you know, I would encourage parents not to beat themselves up if they think they're doing it the wrong way. Probably the most important thing at the individual level is to pay attention to the child. Absolutely. And see what works best for the child in the context of the family as well as the community.
Yeah, I tell people, you know, after a while, just stop with the book, stop with the internet, mm-hmm. and just pay attention to your child and love mm-hmm. your child, because they'll remember that connection you have with them long after they've forgotten, you know, the bedtime schedule and the mm-hmm. discipline that you meted out for some, you know, minor infraction. You know, they will mm-hmm. remember that love and connection that you have with them. So
mm-hmm. absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. From one weird parent to another, I really appreciate your shedding so much light on all the wonderful and diverse parenting practices around the world. So again, thank you, Alma Gottlieb, author of A World of Babies. And we can find your blog at
almagottlieb.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much. It was a wonderful, so much great information. Wonderful to speak with you.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for the opportunity.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.